Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you on a Thursday, the unofficial kickoff to the weekend here in the Crescent City. Thanks for tuning in today, everybody. Happy to have you listening in. If you're listening here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, thank you very much for tuning in. And hey, if you're listening to the podcast, wherever you may be in the country, here in the U.S. or on the planet, I really appreciate that as well. Happy to be here again, as I think I just said that. That's cool. BJ is working the board as always. BJ, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
Doing great, man. Doing great. Fantastic. Happy Thursday. The front has blown through, friends. So we had some bad weather. And here's the part that I'm not complaining about is when the front blows through, it's a little cooler, but it's not humid and it's not hot.
No, that's definitely for sure.
Absolutely. So BJ and I are absolutely in cahoots as our interpretation. Solid meteorology right there in talking about the weather. I'm just happy that I'm not sweating. It's one more day that staves off the long, slow death march, as I like to say, to August here in New Orleans. So there you go, a little reprieve. It's a reprieve because it's already been humid. Anyway, I'm gonna get off that soapbox. Looks like a nice evening tonight. It's going to be a really nice weekend. Friends, next week on the show, wanted to mention a couple things. Next Thursday, we do what we do once a month, and we're going to be recording the show in advance, as we do, as I said, once a month there at Bakery Bar, which is at 1179 Annunciation Street. And what those guys do is they do a little bit of a service industry brunch, and it's, you know, folks from different parts of the service industry, a lot of bartenders and servers and, you know, cook, chef. These guys all kind of turn up, and there's bottomless mimosas and all these other good things. And then we kind of set up shop usually around noon, go till about 2 or 2:30. And just sort of whoever drops by, we do a little bit of a round table and catch up on things. And that'll be fun. I know one of the things that we're going to catch up on was a great event last night. If you caught the show last week, and if you didn't, you can go to noladrinks.com and get the podcast. But a really cool event put on by members of our very concerned, very active service industry here in New Orleans. And it was called They Blinded Me with Science, a Bartender Science Fair. And it was over there in Mid-City on Iberville. And the whole event benefited the Gulf Restoration Network, which is a fantastic cause. And what it was, and if you heard the show again, I do encourage you, because we did a whole hour or so, well, 40 minutes of airtime, if you will, segment with Natasha Nordoff, who's the development director of Gulf Restoration Network, and then Sam Perez and Katie Dubois, two of the three organizers of the event. And it was a fundraiser. And the Gulf Restoration Network, what they do is they have four focus areas of program, and it's all about protecting our Gulf Coast. It's about protecting the people, protecting the economy, protecting us from storm surge and all of that wonderful stuff. And the event was really cool. Four teams of two bartenders each took on each of the four program areas and did a sort of high school, if you will, science fair display complete with a cocktail. So that was not the high school part. That was the adult part of this. And it was the idea was to teach you about the four program areas of the Gulf Restoration Network, and then you got to drink a cocktail and learn about the particular issue, the particular program area of the network, which is really, really cool. And anyway, so it was a great fundraiser, very successful. They had a crawfish boil, had a bit of a cash bar there. It was really a lot of fun. You can go check out the NOLA Drinks Facebook page. There's some stuff. We'll post some more pictures from that event last night. Really good. And there was a whole point to this about why I was talking about Bakery Bar. I have no idea where that all went. But anyway, Bakery Bar... Oh, I know. Some of the people from the event last night are going to be there on Tuesday at Bakery Bar. And we'll talk a little bit more about that event next week as well. I wanted to touch on a few upcoming events here, friends. This Saturday, Jazz in the Vines concert series at Pontchartrain Vineyards kicks off 6:30 Saturday evening. Pontchartrain Vineyards, of course, is up there in Bush, just north of Covington, about an hour from where we sit here in the CBD. Pretty easy drive right there over the causeway and hang out. It's an outdoor concert series, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Dave Jordan and the NIA, which stands for the Neighborhood Improvement Association, if you really want to know, they're kicking off the concert series, and that'll be a lot of fun. Tickets are $10 at the gate, or you can buy them online, and they also have a special offer where you can get two tickets and a bottle of wine for just $25. So go check out PontchartrainVineyards.com, friends. It's going to be a lot of fun. You get to sit outside, as I said, the vineyard's right there, tasting room. They got wine for sale, food trucks, all this good stuff. Of course, next weekend kicks off my favorite music festival here in the Crescent City, French Quarter Festival. That starts on Thursday, August 6th, and runs through Sunday, which is going to be, what, that's the 9th, I think. So there you go, can't add. I think it's the 9th. That sounds about right, mathematically. Free concert, friends. If you live here, you probably know about this one. Okay, everybody talks about Jazz Fest, which is really cool, and I totally dig Jazz Fest. But French Quarter Festival is awesome. It's free. It's all local bands, like Southeast Louisiana bands, and they set up stages throughout the French Quarter, and they've kind of stretched out a little bit, a couple of environs a little outside the French Quarter. But there are about 25 stages, give or take, 22, something like that. They range from these little stages on Royal Street or over there in the French Market playing traditional jazz to big stages at Waldenburg Park right there along the Mississippi River with some heavy hitters. And every year the festival gets a little bit bigger. So, you know, way back when the festival was one stage in Jackson Square, my lovely wife Sylvia is sitting here and she's nodding because she grew up here. And so she goes back to like before the time when there was amplified music and it was just one stage in Jackson Square. Oh, now I'm getting the look. Never mind. But one stage in Jackson Square has now grown, as I said, to 20-something stages all throughout the French Quarter, free Thursday through Sunday. But now what we get is, then it was, you know, 2 days, and then it was 3 days, or kind of kicked off in the late afternoon on Friday. That goes back maybe 8 years or so, and then now it's pretty much 4 full days. Things start at 11 o'clock on Thursday. They don't have all the stages running on Thursday and probably Friday, but it starts to ramp up, and you see stuff. You see Zydeco, you see Cajun, you see jazz, you see traditional jazz, you see funk, you see R&B, you see a bit of hip hop, you see all kinds of brass bands, man. Serious. So go check out French Quarter Festival, and their website is fqfi.org. So that's French Quarter Festival Incorporated, fqfi.org. We'll talk more about that next week. We're going to get into the lineup a little bit and some things like that. Hogs for the Cause coming up this weekend also on Friday and Saturday. We'll talk a little bit more about that coming out of the break, get you some more particulars. So sometimes people think that event is Saturday and Sunday. It's actually Friday and Saturday. You can watch some demonstrations, some really cool stuff, good music, good food, great cause, all that stuff. We'll come back to that one. And then also, what else? That's pretty much, those are the ones that I wanted to highlight. Now, friends, last weekend was a whole serious set of events. You know, we do a lot of eating and drinking and all that kind of stuff, and festivals, tastings, these sorts of things connected to that here in New Orleans. And, you know, we know how to do that, right? We know how to do tastings. There's almost a tasting of some sort of festival, some sort of concept, some sort of something every single weekend, if not any given evening. Last weekend was a big one. So we had three brand new festivals that went on last weekend. I kicked off Thursday night with Top Taco New Orleans. You heard us, if you listen to the show, heard us talk about that a lot over the preceding two or three episodes. Very cool event over there at Spanish Plaza. And then there was the Bourbon Festival. I'll come back to that one in a second. That was Friday and Saturday principally. Really cool stuff. And then it really kind of cap things off, as I sort of said in a written piece that I'm getting at here, the icing on the cake, or the garnish on the drink, if you will, for Bloody Mary Festival. That was an event that took place at Howlin' Wolf, the famed music venue, and that's was really cool. So that was Sunday afternoon, 12 local restaurants doing Bloody Marys, and that was a really neat event. And where I'm going with this is that we put out a written piece on the NOLADrinks.com website yesterday, kind of talking about last weekend. We went to all three. I had the great pleasure being a judge at Top Taco New Orleans on the cocktail side. Great event there. And then Bloody Mary Fest on Sunday was great. And then what I wanted to mention with Bourbon Festival, which was Friday and Saturday, I guess, you know, they did some paired dinners and some things like that starting on Thursday. But they did two grand tastings Friday and Saturday evening that were pretty much the same bourbon producers. Restaurants, they kind of changed up a little bit. And then Saturday during the day, they did a whole bunch of seminars, which I thought was a really neat component to the inaugural New Orleans Bourbon Festival. And again, all three of these festivals were brand new newbies, and they were all very successful. We're going to get these again next year, which I think is really, really exciting. But I went to three panels. The first one I went to was the State of the Bourbon Industry, and this was led by a gentleman named Chuck Condry. And Chuck is a noted bourbon author and a historian to a degree out of Kentucky. And he was talking about, again, sort of the state of the industry, but it was very casual, and he went on for a while. Actually, it was supposed to go about an hour and a half. It went 2.5 hours because the guy is just full of stories. It was just, you know, sitting in Booker No's kitchen drinking bourbon and stuff. It was really, really cool. And then another one was a panel was called Women in Bourbon, led by three very talented women who talked about their organization, talked about tasting. We did a lead tasting with them. Great panel there. And then the last one was a historian named Michael Veach. And Michael Veach is an author, has a brand new book out called, I believe it's called American Whiskey. And he talks about the history of bourbon. And he did this particular talk on the New Orleans connection to bourbon, and it was really interesting. Lots of things that kind of blew myths of different stuff out of the water. One of them is his theory is that the name of bourbon actually does not come from Bourbon County in Kentucky, but is actually derived from Bourbon Street here in New Orleans. Now, apocryphal, people in Kentucky might say, but here in New Orleans, that sounds pretty good to us, I think. But we'll talk a little bit more about that next week, too. I want to get into that. And Michael, one of the things with him is he's going to be coming down to do some more research in the archives of the Historic New Orleans Collection and some other stuff. And we'll do a segment on that in the show next week, because I want to go over my notes from that and talk a bit about what he's up to. And then hopefully we'll have him on the show in the coming months when he's down here. Speaking of authors, we have a good show for you today. Coming up here right after the break, author Sarah Baird, who has just walked in. Author of a brand new book called New Orleans Cocktail. She's waving, and we're waving back. It's radio, so I'm just sort of giving the play-by-play here. We're all waving. BJ, everybody's waving. Really cool. And that's going to be really fun. We're going to talk about her book, her background, what made her write the book. We're going to talk about the drinks in the book, because that's what we do on this show. And then in the second hour, we're going to welcome Robert LeBlanc, who is the proprietor of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, owner of such fantabulous places as Sylvain Cavan, Barrel Proof, and Mobar, along with Sean Josephs, who is the proprietor of Kenton's. If you happen to catch the show back on January 20th, you can go get the podcast. If you didn't, we talked a little bit about the state of the restaurant industry and a particular focus on New Orleans, of course, and independent sit-down restaurants. And we're going to continue that conversation with those guys. So friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show and come on back. We're going to be here chatting with Sarah Baird, author of New Orleans Cocktails. Little Baby Dodge Trio, Tutti Ma is a big fine thing. Come on back.
Tutti Ma is a big fine thing. Who's on this? Swing that thing. Tutti Ma can shake that thing. Who's on this? Swing that thing. Tutti Ma can shake that thing.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu. Life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Well, after I'm through this bottle of wine, I'm gonna take you out, girl, and spend some time. If I do, just one more round.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. A little Eric Lindell for you, friends. Eric, well, you know, he's actually originally from my homeland out there in Northern California. He grew up in San Mateo and then was living in the New Orleans area for a while. And now I believe he lives over on the panhandle of Florida, but still plays around town quite a bit. So there you go. Check out his music. He's a good fella, by the way. Pleased to be joined by Sarah Baird, author of the brand spanking new, pretty close to brand spanking new, 2 months, right?
Yeah, it's still a new baby, right?
I'm going to call that brand spanking
new. Yeah, brand spanking new.
There you go. New Orleans Cocktails, over 100 drinks from the sultry streets and balconies of the Big Easy. Really cool book, a lot of fun. And so, Sarah, you know, we were just talking about this right before we went on the air. lots of cocktail books out there in the world, even a few about New Orleans, but you've kind of done so it's not just sort of how you make the corpse survivor number two.
Sure.
It's you got a little bit more going on in the book as far as, and we're going to get into all this stuff, but we have the comparison of the classics and then some new interpretations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't write a New Orleans cocktail book without it being kind of classically, you know, without having the classics in there. But something that I think that this book does is delves into kind of the modern state of the New Orleans cocktail and gets to involve a lot of the bartenders on the scene right now who are really pushing the envelope of what it means to be kind of a bar in New Orleans right now and bringing in new elements that haven't been seen in the past. So it's not just, you know, the history of the Sazerac for the 17,000th time.
We were talking about that too right before. We went on the air, you know, our David Wondrich out there and some other folks that do cocktail history stuff kind of have those bases covered. They've geeked out in the archives. They've geeked out and gone through the newspapers and all that stuff. It doesn't need to be done again.
Yeah. It's beautiful. They're experts. Like, it's great.
It informs the story, right? We all build on each other in the world of history.
Exactly.
And absolutely. And so that's really cool. And I think, you know, it's interesting what you just said, too. In this town, we honor tradition, and so the classics, they're meaningful. So, like, if you walk into a bar and if I order a Sazerac and you can't make a good one, I'm going to judge you as being not a very good bar.
Oh, right.
Frankly. But it is also a city where we, outside of walking that line, we also welcome creativity. We welcome spontaneity and some of these other things. So it is an interesting fine line to walk, isn't it? Where you have to know the stuff, you have to know the tradition, but then you put a spin on it. Without going too far, probably, right?
Yeah, well, that's the mark of like a true pro here. It's
there you
like
go.
That balancing act, right? It's
yep.
that you can't not know the classics, like the canon, like the New Orleans classic cocktail canon. Like anyone who comes here, like that's just kind of your foundation. But finding that balance of bringing in new elements of New Orleans culture that haven't been touched on before without taking it into this like weirdo extreme, like to a bridge too far direction is kind of the mark, you know?
right. And that's another great point. I have this conversation a lot. I have a lot of bartenders on the show and lots of very good friends, and I know people we know in common. And there's a real aside from the fact that I think in many establishments and in most places here, we don't need to call somebody a mixologist. If you're a bartender, you're a pro. It's a trade, it's a craft, and we know that and what you bring to the table when you do that. And I think the sensibility that also comes with that, putting that aside a little bit, is you know, there's a practicality. I don't want to spend $20 on a cocktail and wait 20 minutes to get it while you carve a dolphin out of a piece of pineapple.
Oh, sure. Exactly. Right. There's also like a practicality in how beautiful it is to be a bartender because it is being a craftsman, right? Mm-hmm. It's a craft and it's an art and it's this thing, but that doesn't necessarily, but it's also something that the difference between being an artist and a craftsman a little bit is that practicality, right? Like, you know that you're going to have to deliver those drinks in, you know, a fair amount of time instead of, you know, spending 30 minutes, you know, hand carving the ice and then, you know, setting it on fire and watching it melt and then we all clap, you know?
Right. The Benihana approach.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's exactly, and that's really the case. And that practicality, as you well said, I think is really understood here in the professional level of the tradespeople that we have.
Absolutely.
being bartenders. Well, let's roll this back real quick here. Where are you from originally? Let's talk about you a little bit here.
Well, you were talking about Kentucky a little bit. I'm originally from Kentucky.
Oh, really?
So I might
cool.
take offense with the bourbon.
I'm sorry.
That you
blame
said.
Michael Veatch. That was not me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I still think it's Bourbon County, not Bourbon Street. But that's just how I was raised. But yeah, I mean, that's a very natural progression to lived a lot of places, but from Kentucky originally, here now. That's a very natural sort of progression, right? To go from bourbon country to be
come down the river, right? I mean,
yeah.
Like we're talking about how bourbon ended up here, right? You come down the Ohio River and then you merge into the Mississippi and you find yourself in New Orleans.
Bourbon and me. Yeah,
exactly. perfect.
That's it, yeah.
So now how long have you been here, Sarah?
About 7.5-8 years. Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah,
and now where did I know you've written other books, and we'll talk about that after the break too, but how'd you become an author? I mean, did you go to school? Did you do lit or something at university?
I actually did anthropology.
Anthro
stuff kind of is how I got into it, and I think that that's always a good way to get into history, get into kind of like culture, so you're not just looking at drinks or food or whatever you're looking at through the lens of what's in the glass, right? You're looking at it as, you know, what's the historical context, like what's the cultural context, what does this drink actually mean to people, right?
Right.
So, and that's why I think that this book and kind of talking about drinks in that sort of anthropological, sociological sort of way is nice. Yeah.
That's really cool. And, you know, and to me, and that's a really good point too, because I think to me, the better books that are out there, I mean, because again, we're talking about things that are done. There are a voluminous amount of volumes of cocktail books where you can, and then, you know, go Google whatever recipe you want for a drink online. It's the cultural context that we're talking about, the sociological context that we're talking about that I think that, I know that some of that stuff goes back decades having that conversation in some ways, but I think it's gotten more serious and academic in the past 15 or 20 years.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, the past 10 years especially, it's just been, it's kind of boomed in terms of, you know, people really getting scholarly, like top to bottom about what cocktails look like. And especially here in New Orleans, I mean, there's just so much because, you know, the history is so rich that it's very exciting and a very exciting time to be working with New Orleans cocktails in terms of history and also what it means now, you know, like what cocktails mean to the city right in this moment.
Right.
Because it's different. You know, it's a very unique time to talk about that.
We're going
to
hold that thought, Sarah. We're going to come back. We're going to take care of our bottom of the hour business here on the NOLA Drink Show. Take a little break. Chatting with Sarah Baird, author of New Orleans Cocktails. Friends, come on back.
Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranac's, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Go down by the cow with it. Give it to him. Holly golly. Jump. Give it to him. Give it to him.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show, WGSO 990 AM here in New Orleans. Brian Diaz here with you on a Thursday. Yep, little Kermit Ruffins and Rebirth. I got a woman. Sort of made me think about French Quarter Festival because I don't know if Rebirth is going to be there or Kermit, probably. And some Kermit is? Okay, cool. We'll talk about the schedule on that next week. But anyway, hey, we are chatting with Sarah Baird, author of New Orleans Cocktails, a new book. Brand spank. It's a new baby, as you said.
Yeah.
And we're talking, it's cool, kind of a bit of a different approach. So we were talking during the break a little bit about your educational background. You studied anthropology, and then you did some study at London School of Economics.
Yep.
Which wasn't, people think economics, man, but it's not just economics there at that school.
No, anthropology is a very big thing. So it's a big school for that. And, you know, I think that New Orleans, you know, kind of anthropology in New Orleans is also like a beautiful sort of hybrid situation, right? Because it is kind of sociology, anthropology, kind of the what your background even in you know, kind of like in the environmental politics sort of thing. Everything kind of plays into that, and then food plays into that as well. So it's kind of like this beautiful package that it's a city that recognizes that all those things are incredibly interlaced and fit in together.
And we like those stories, don't we, Sarah, here as far as the storytelling. So I mean, we can almost use the term interchangeably, anthropology and history. These things are going to maybe apply a little bit more of an academic rigor, but ultimately what it comes down to is good storytelling in a lot of ways. And that's where we are with this stuff.
Well, sure. I mean, everyone in New Orleans, I mean, you meet like a native New Orleanian, like they all can spin a yarn like nobody's business, right? Like the person you right. saddle up next to at a bar, like that person probably has like 10 stories and they'll be able to talk to you all night about it. And it's not just the stories of the drinks and those kinds of tales, right? Like it's, you know, kind of the personal histories that you get when you go into these bars and you get to chat with everybody and build those relationships. And it becomes this, you know, it's a community, and it's a community of storytellers who really want to tell their stories, which is kind of a beautiful thing, and also want to bring you into that in a fun, in a way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, make you a part of it, and it's a welcoming situation. I think we always talk about this, too, where, you know, and I'm going to get off on a tangent on this a little bit, too. It's when, if you move, and I'm a transplant, my wife's a local, if you come here and you try too hard, you don't have to be Mr. and Mrs. New Orleans. Be yourself. That's how it kind of works for you. And then the culture becomes accepting of you. And I think you become a part of it. Then you become part of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there really is kind of a you know, if unless you're a jerk, and like if you're a jerk, like don't even try. But like, you know, but if you you know, if you're ready to be like, I love New Orleans, New Orleans will love you back in the same way, you know, and you don't try to go over the top and be this kind of like, you know, like I'm gonna wear like a crawfish t-shirt every day, and you know, like, you know, right. I like mainline beignets, and you know, I don't know, like where I don't know
right,
all
exactly.
the horrible things that you can do
exactly,
yeah, to go over the top, yeah.
Exactly. You don't need to go to a funeral of somebody that you don't know.
Please
don't. And participate in the
please,
second line.
Please never do that.
Yeah,
yeah
right.
Yeah.
I mean, when somebody like a musician of some sort or something, you know, locally passes away and they've meant something to your life,
sure.
different story. But,
yeah.
you know, it's sort of, yeah, you can just chill. Just chill a little bit.
Absolutely.
Chill and go with it.
You
That's
know what you should
thing.
Do? You should probably just have a drink instead.
You should probably have a drink
yeah,
instead.
Pour but, one out.
There you go. And so with that, in regards to the book, so we do a little bit of comparison stuff. Let's get into that a little bit further. So we talked about the, you know, the importance of honoring the tradition. And then we have this creative scene that goes on here. So who did you talk to and how did you sort of come up with the process and how did that kind of pan out basically?
Yeah, I you know, I really wanted to do something that was a little bit different. So one thing that I really wanted to spotlight is kind of, you know, kind of like these older drinks that nobody has, kind of weird drinks from some antiquated sort of books that, and give them to modern bartenders and have them update them.
Could you give us a couple examples?
Yeah, sure. So there was like this, I mean, he's no longer here, but there's a book, a thing called the Tangipahoa Parish Punch. And it's kind of this very, you know, it's a party punch, right? It's very fun. And
is it a traditional punch?
It's just rum and juice.
Yep.
The bartender who I gave it to, he's in New York now, but he worked at Cane and Table. And so he did just these like...
Is this Scott?
It was Scott. Yeah.
Steerwalt. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he called it in the kind of blurb, the guy was like, there was kind of this story in the blurb about the original punch where the guy was like, you know, I told my friend from the parish that like, I made this punch that was his. And he said, Nerds, that's not it. You know? And so Scott named it like the Nerds punch. You know? it was this very, very clever, fun, kind of playful update on that with lots of new liqueurs and adding that stuff in and doing a lot of stuff with lemongrass and things like that. So that was fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then our good friend Mark Shetler, who's a friend of the show, often on the show. What did Mark do?
Mark just did a bunch of stuff about Tonique. You know, I talk a lot in there about, because I think it's such a great bar in terms of being this sort of hybrid between being very service industry oriented and then also, you know, like they do the classics like crazy. Like everyone there is just like, you know, on point all the time with anything they need. And they right. do such a volume. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just kind of this amazing sort of balance that they have. So I really love that. And another big thing that we talked about, like with him, is kind of just this kind of, they call it, I forget exactly what he calls it, but it's like the Tonique special, I think, which is like like the Moscow Mule and the way they do a Sazerac, like and you can get those like together.
Yeah, the hybrid one.
So that I could do like the back to back sort of thing with that. So I think that that's something that we talked about a lot in the book, and also like, you know, a little bit of anecdotal stuff about my own experiences at Tonique, like how I spent an unexpectedly late night there and missed a flight to Barbados once.
That happens. That does happen at that place, doesn't it?
You get sucked in, and then you're just like, my 6 a.m. flight is not going to happen.
Let me ask you this, because this is a tangent on Bar Tonique. And friends, if you're listening to the show, you may not know the bar. It's on Rampart, 700-800 block of Rampart. And it's sort of this divey kind of place. But as you said, everybody there is on point. That bar has gone on to spur the careers of almost anybody that's ever worked in there. Has gone on to do something else. Not that staying there is not really awesome, too. It used to be, when I would go in there, not too long after they first opened, and I'm not a super late night person, so I generally, like, you'll find me there on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, or sometimes like, you know, Thursday at 1 o'clock before the show, and hanging out. And whenever somebody would be in there and I would talk to them, they were from out of town. This is going back a few years. And I would say, how did you find this place? Obviously you've been in New Orleans like 5 or 6 times. Yeah. Because you wouldn't know about Bar Tonique if you know, this is 5 years removed. You wouldn't know about it had you not been here a bunch of times, and somebody eventually at some other establishment said, you like drinks, you need to go here. Mm-hmm. And now I find that not for the worse, the vibe is still the same, but now I don't have that assumption anymore. People know about Bar Tonique. People seek Bar Tonique out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I think it's been on several lists, and I think that that's helped a lot nationally in terms of—
I think on like a Southwest Magazine airline article or something.
Yeah, there were a couple of things, and it was like, you know, like—
Sellouts.
Yeah. Under the radar gin, you know, something like that. But I think that's a big part of it. I also think the whole stretch of Rampart has kind of come back in an interesting, especially with the traffic and the parking, and that's all kind of being the streetcar and all that's kind of being fixed. You know, you have Black Penny just a little bit down the ways, you know, if you want to like get a cocktail, get a beer, and kind of run that loop a little bit.
Mo Bar
right up there. Yeah, exactly. So I think that that's kind of also helped sort of build out an infrastructure too when it comes to drinks.
Absolutely. We do talk a lot about that on the show. Somebody said, I can't remember who said this a while back, it's sort of the last grand avenue to be restored in New Orleans, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it's such an important historical with Armstrong Park, Congo Square right there, the old Cosmo and Patassa, now laundromat, recording studio, all of that. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff going on, that new champagne bar, Effervescence, that opened up a couple weeks back. Well, Sarah, let me ask you, so how you've written other books, and what are some of the other publications of yours?
In terms of books, I wrote a short stack edition, which is like a series of single ingredient cookbooks about summer squash. Lots of cocktails in there, a couple of cocktails in there too, but it's about summer squash mainly. And contributed to the larger publication about that, a book called Kentucky Sweets, because I am from there, which also kind of has a stronger anthropological focus on kind of oral histories and things like that. Cool. But for each of the recipes, there's a, you know, obviously like a complimentary cocktail on that front. So, you know, you get a recipe for, you know, you can't call it Derby pie. You have to call it May Day pie for copyright reasons.
Oh,
right?
Really?
But you have
okay.
like bourbon
oh, okay.
cocktails along with that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
kind of things appropriate for celebrations and kind of bringing that to the masses in terms of making it more accessible. Yeah.
So obviously, and this was actually going to be my next question because you had written about stuff entirely different. What prompted the fascination or interest in cocktails then? Because obviously you've been imbuing that in your books and your writings for a while. How'd you get into that? What fascinates you with that?
Yeah, I think that cocktails, even more so than food in a lot of ways, they're kind of like the conduit to conversation. Right? They're kind of like, you know, it is that kind of like social lubricant, even more so than breaking bread, that really gets people to like talk and communicate with each other. And also it's, you know, it's something that people would like, you know, people really enjoy talking about what they drink, even more so I find sometimes than what they eat. You know, mm-hmm. people are excited to find even like a new beer or a new wine or even a new coffee shop, you know, and they want to talk about that. And it's something that feels pretty accessible for everyone, but also a way that people get together and just start these conversations that otherwise might not happen.
That's a great point. I think, you know, you certainly have I think with and food too, but with cocktails and alcohol, you have, you know, you can take it to the far end of the epistemic community, you know, and totally geek out. And I mean, go like hardcore molecular bio or hardcore history or whatever we're talking about. Or you could just say, damn, this is a fine beer.
Sure.
And then, you know, trade why I like my particular beer that I'm drinking.
Yeah. And all of that is equally important, right?
Yep.
And, you know, it's kind of a common ground. Like it can be very polarizing and very, you know, divisive in some points, you know, and you can make it as infighty as you want, just like anything else.
The old Coors Budweiser debate, that one. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, you know, like if you really want to duke it out over like, you know, like, yeah. Whether or not you like a high life, you can totally go down that path. But also like it's a great way to really just bring people together. And, you know, and there's just so much innovation happening now too. I just feel like people are very excited about not only the different ways that they can change up not only cocktails, but like spirits in general, right? And change things on that front and experiment and make new spirits and move in that direction, especially in the U.S. I mean, like, even like if you're looking at something like American vermouth, right? Like that's like brand new almost, mm-hmm. you know, like that sort of resurgence, but everyone's just hyped about it. And there's a subset and, you know, it's like there's like a community for everyone. And I feel like the cocktail world, the drinks world, the spirits world really offers that in a way that can still be a little bit not inclusive for food specifically.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Friends, we're chatting with author Sarah Baird of New Orleans Cocktails. We're going to come back and chat with her a little bit more. We're going to tell you a little bit about where you can find this cool book and talk a little bit more maybe about some of your interpretations on where things are here in New Orleans and beyond with the spirits, beer, cocktail world. Hey, friends. Well, speaking of which, the history of drinks in New Orleans, Good Jack's Boogie. This was an old promotional tune by Dave Bartholomew. We're talking about Cosmo Matassa's studio. That'll all make sense. I'll tie that back up when we come back. Friends, come on back to the Noel Drink Show.
Grab a Jack and be a leader. And drink Jack beer.
Drink Jack beer.
Mellow Jack beer.
Mellow Jack beer.
Hello, Mellow Jack. Best of beer in town.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the Small Plates and Charcuterie Kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. If you're listening to the podcast, thanks for doing that. If you'd like to listen to the podcast, go check it out on noladrinks.com. Easiest way to get it. It's on iTunes, Google Play Music, and TuneIn Radio. Just real quickly, I was mentioning we were playing Dave Bartholomew, Good Jack's Boogie. That was Dave Bartholomew, if you don't know who he is, famous New Orleans musician, probably most known, although a great band leader in his own right, as the band leader for Fats Domino forever. And what was pretty common during that time is musicians would record promo pieces. And this one was for, of course, the historic Jack's Brewery there in the quarter on Decatur, and that was just a little promotional music piece, but it was actually like a tune and like a really good New Orleans tune, so we play it on the show.
Nice.
Yeah, there you go. We're talking about history a little bit here. We're talking with author Sarah Baird, author of New Orleans Cocktails, an elegant collection of over 100 recipes inspired by the Big Easy. Sarah, is the subtitle Over 100 Drinks from the Sultry Streets and Balconies of the Big Easy?
I like that one a little bit more.
Right? I like that
it's a little bit sexier. That's a fun title, yeah.
Anytime you use the word sultry in New Orleans,
yeah,
it makes me think of like Tennessee Williams and all this other stuff.
Yeah, so, exactly. That's much better. Yeah. More sultry than elegant. Let's go with that.
We sweat a lot in August, so that's not really elegant, but it can be sultry.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like sultry is elegant sweating.
Yes,
right?
There you go. That word sultry does, it really kind of, it does for some reason like imply heat in some fashion and maybe sweat. So Well, Sarah, we were talking a little bit during the break, the creativity sort of, we talked about this earlier, knowing your tradition, walking the line, maybe paraphrasing, but got to know the rules to break them sort of thing. And we've seen here, a lot of creativity in the bar scene. We've also seen, I think, kind of commensurate to that, a significant uptick in the number of distilleries and breweries in Southeast Louisiana.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been kind of huge over the past, especially even 3 or 4 years.
Absolutely.
It's kind of exploded, and definitely, concerns about a bubble necessarily with that, but it's exciting to see what everyone's doing and the way that people are kind of embracing beer kind of for the first time in a very fun sort of way that they haven't before. Down here, it's definitely a spirits town above all else, and then wine second and beer kind of like trotted in slowly in third. But now that's kind of changing. There's really a shifting sort of dynamic with that.
As you said, lots of creativity. And I think one of the things that's been interesting about the beer too is with a lot of the popping up of the craft breweries in the area, I think it's even pushed people that will remain nameless to make better beer where maybe they were slacking for a little while. And some of the other breweries that have been around for a little while, there's more competition. So you got small guys making 3 or 4 labels that are doing really good things with those beers. Mm-hmm. And it's raise the bar.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's really pushed the big dogs who, for forever were just kind of like, we don't have any, to really be like, oh gosh, somebody is really changing the game. And people are responding to it, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what people want now. They want these kind of thoughtful, very, a lot of thoughts gone into them, very specific sort of crafted brews. And the older sort of stalwart, with any sort of corporation versus small guy sort of thing, they're kind of having to respond. And it's funny to see kind of the David and Goliath, kind of like the David sort of push those big beer Goliaths around a little bit.
That's good. I like it.
Yeah.
And, these places have tasting rooms and stuff where you can go interact with them. If you're from out of the area, easy to find stuff. There's all kinds of great breweries around. And then with some of the changes in the laws, we've also really past couple years a significant uptick in distilleries as well.
Oh yeah, and it's cool to see even breweries get into distilling, right? So like that sort of cross-pollination too, to see that spirits like beer, like everything kind of can live under this one sort of fun drink
umbrella, you know, and yeah. people are starting to push themselves in different directions on that as well.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think you would have even seen 5 years ago. I think that that would be something that everything was pretty siloed. And now people are like figuring out ways to even work together a little bit more across sort of, you know, wine, beer, spirits, kind of like finding that intersection in a nicer way.
Absolutely. That's pretty cool. And there's, I'm spraying this. People listen to the show regularly now. I'm the marketing director for Pontchartrain Vineyards across the lake. So we've had lots of conversations with people about wanting barrels for things, producing some interesting products with one of the local distillers we're talking with and some other stuff that I think is just exactly as you said, these conversations. You know, there's just a lot of talk yeah. going around. And like you said, siloed before, I think was the case. And those with everybody, all these small folks, the all bets are off and how this stuff is going to start to go.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but you know, kind of like removing those silos also means that, you know, you get so much more information that you might not have before in terms of what you bring into your own business too. Right. So like
right.
you learn from beer, like wine learns from beer and spirits learns from this. And it creates a larger community that's, you know, not only like across the city, but across the lake. Right. And, you know, like parish wide and outside the parishes and then the entire region. So I feel like there's also a lot more reaching into different places to like bring all that together, which is very cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really neat. Well, Sarah, let's do this. We got about 2 minutes, 2-3 minutes left. Where can people find the book?
Any sort of independent store around town, Garden District Books, things like that. You can also Barnes & Noble, Amazon online, in pretty much any online sort of spot for that. But go to your local bookseller and buy it there.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of that. So yeah, that's really cool. So there, and I've seen it. So give us a couple names, some of the, especially for people. Always, we do have a lot of people listen to the podcast from out of town. And it's like, if you're coming to town and you want to go hit up a local sure. bookseller, let's mention a few.
I would say, actually, I mean, I'm always partial to Kitchen Witch. You know, they do some fun stuff. And you can pick up some other, if you're into drinks and food, they'll have that. Garden District, Maple Street, all that kind of stuff. I'm trying to think where else. All the, basically, I mean, you know, anywhere that you can stumble to a bookstore, it'll probably be there.
Now, have you done, did you do some book signings with this when it first came out?
I did when it first came out. Most of those, since it was carnival season.
Right.
Yeah. Most of those were...
right. The great distractor.
Exactly. Most of those were outside of town. So okay. it was a good time to get out and use it as a platform to talk about New Orleans and New Orleans cocktails and other cities, because they don't have the blessed, you know, Tuesday event that, you know, we get to have in the weeks leading up to it.
Right.
But their lives are boring in February. But, but you know, that'll be over the next month or so, kind of getting back into that and doing some
locally
stuff
here.
Around town.
Oh, great. Okay, town. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, that's cool. Keep me posted on when you do that so we can absolutely. Talk about it here and let people know about
yeah.
it. And anything, how can people find you? Do you have like an online presence where they can find some of your other publications and writings and things
sure,
like
yeah.
that?
I mean, you can follow me on Twitter at SC Baird, or you can, SC.
SC as in Cat Baird.
As in Cat
okay.
Baird.
Okay.
And then, we can do, hellosarahbaird.com.
Okay. Awesome.
Perfect.
Sarah, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
Thanks for talking about
Thank
the book.
So much. Yeah.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's kind of one of those funny things. So we know all kinds of people in common. It's kind of funny we haven't met until
I know,
today
right?
in person. But anyway, happy to have you here. We'll have you back on the show sometime soon and keep us posted about the book signings and
Absolutely.
Things like
Thank
that.
You so much.
Absolutely. Friends, author Sarah Baird, author of New Orleans Cocktails. We're going with this one, subtitled Over 100 Drinks from the Sultry Streets and Balconies of the Big Easy. Really cool book. Check it on out. We're going to be back with hour number 2 of the NOLA Drink Show. Going to be joined, that's what I'm trying to say, by Robert LeBlanc of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group and Sean Josephs of Kenton's. We're going to talk about the restaurant business, friends. Business, friends. Jeez. Come on back.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Happy Thursday, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. We are awaiting the arrival of Robert LeBlanc and Sean Josephs, who will be here in just a minute. I just got a text from Robert saying they just parked, and that was 2 minutes ago. So they'll be here momentarily, and we'll get them on. But I did mention that I was going to circle back to Hogs for the Cause, a really good event coming up. It actually starts tomorrow, and it's tomorrow and Saturday, and it kicks off in the afternoon tomorrow. It's there at the UNO Arena Grounds on the lakefront, and it's a charitable cause. It's really interesting. A lot of great bands. They've got three stages. It's actually a very large event and a fundraising event primarily for children's health issues, so stuff connected to families, pediatric brain cancer, and so some of the different medical institutions and things like that benefit from this as a fundraiser. You have people out there doing all kinds of great hog stuff, barbecue, smoking, cochon de lait, all that really good stuff. There's all kinds of different tickets, so you can sort of get the one-day general admission, two-day general admission. There's actually, it starts about 2:30. There's a hoggy hour. You can do that, and then there's all stuff ranging all the way to like the VIP stuff, the highest level ticket being the two-day Boss Hog ticket, and that's $310. The single tickets are about $25. If you're interested in checking out Hogs for the Cause and attending the event, I highly encourage you to do so. That is hogsforthecause.org. Again, hogsforthecause.org. Friends, our guests have arrived. Sean and Robert are here, and they are bearing wine. They are bringing gifts. I appreciate it. Gentlemen, thank you. Welcome to the show.
We realize the only reason we get invited on the show is because we come with wine, so.
Yeah, that's good. And, I mean, you know, it's not bourbon, but it's wine, so. That'll work. We had this interesting email exchange back and forth, and Sean, really, you were the voice of reason, saying, let's kind of ease into this one a little bit instead of doing bourbon straight out like we did last time.
I'm rarely the voice of reason, so that's I hope my wife is listening.
Earning points there. So friends, and if you heard the show at the beginning, we were talking about this, but Sean Josephs is the proprietor of Kenton's there, Uptown Magazine Street, and a fantastic new restaurant, right, Sean? I mean, you got how year,
yeah,
and a half?
Year and a half now.
Yeah. Okay, great. I got that right. I'm rarely right about anything. And then Robert LeBlanc is here, who is the proprietor of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, the owners of Kevin, also Uptown on Magazine, Sylvain and Mo Bar in the French Quarter, and a Barrel Proof there, as we like to say, in the lower Garden District.
Yeah, that's Liam. I mean, he thinks he's so cool.
Yeah, he does think he's pretty cool, and he's down there. And we've been calling it the LLG, the lower Garden District now.
I mean, look, that guy, all hat, no cattle.
There you go. Go check out Barrel Proof on Magazine. Thank you, Sean, for pouring some wine. And aside from making fun of our good friend Liam Deegan, who is the co-proprietor with Roe of Barrel Proof, if you guys listen to the show on the 27th of January, these two guys are on, and we had a bit of a conversation about the state of the restaurant industry, and we were focusing, of course, by and large on the New Orleans area. And then we are also talking about, by definition here, independent sit-down restaurants. And it's a topic that we'll continue to come back to. And these guys have interesting insight into the topic. And the first show, and go back and check out the podcast feed and catch it then, we talked quite a bit. I think the main theme, guys, if I remember correctly, was we talked a lot about saturation going on here in the New Orleans marketplace. And I think one of the main takeaways for me anyway was that we talked about so many restaurants coming and going, and the phenomena has maybe changed, or the dynamic has changed a little bit, where it's not just you go out of business because you're doing a bad job. There are a lot of good restaurants that did a good job that went out of business.
Correct. Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Some great restaurants.
And it's and so, I mean, I think, are we still kind of feeling that same dynamic now, or do we think that some of the, it seems that the openings have maybe slowed slightly, but not a lot. I mean, we're still getting a lot of new stuff.
I feel like the openings have slowed a good bit. There's a lot of hotel inventory coming online, so mm-hmm. a lot of those guys have restaurants, and but the thought there is they're bringing in 100 to 150 guests a night to populate those restaurants as well. So I don't know that affects it as much, but I think it's slowed down a little bit. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I guess I got the same sense. I mean, I think you would know better than me, but just reading, you know, kind of local food publications, I guess I feel like fewer things have come online, but hard to know if that's just the season.
That's a good point. I think some of the neighborhoods, you know, where you see like Rampart, new stuff's opening up there. We're talking a little bit about that in the first hour indirectly. But you know, and this is totally anecdotal. I have no evidence of this at all. But it just seems like if you go back a couple of years, some like in the Bywater, taking that for example, somebody would close down and then somebody would snatch that spot up right away and try and open up something else. And I don't see some of the vacancies filling as quickly.
That you're absolutely correct on that. We're getting a lot more calls now about vacancies than we did as recently as 3 months ago.
Okay. Yeah,
for sure.
So, and so, you know, again, we talked about that. I mean, maybe that's the slight different dynamic. I think on in this particular, and we can circle back on any of this stuff, you guys. As you know, we script nothing on this show, and it probably shines through clearly. You know, with one of the things that we really didn't get to though is talking about some of the economics of running an independent sit down restaurant in here in New Orleans. So, you know, the cost associated and some of those barriers. We did touch on, I think, a little bit with chain restaurants having obviously an advantage of economies of scale. But what we didn't really talk about too much is with your two particular sets of operations, you know, the people think, you know, oh, I get this a lot in the wine business, right? Oh, you own a winery or you make wine, you must be rich. And the margins are razor thin when you're a small producer. And I think the margins are razor thin in a restaurant of the natures of what you guys run. Is that also fair? I mean, generally?
I think it's fair to say that the common or conventional wisdom is the two worst places that you could ever put your money would be a Broadway show or a restaurant.
Right. I think I've spoken from a true New Yorker's perspective. Right, right. Like
that's yeah. So here, I guess the Broadway show less relevant. But yeah, I think the reason that restaurants are considered to be such a bad business, and Ro and I were actually talking about this on the way over, is because 5% margin is actually considered to be acceptable or decent. Like, I think that would be the kind of, if you were to look at the standard, someone would say, well, if you're doing 5%, you're actually not doing bad. If you're doing 10%, you're doing really, really well. And if you're doing 15%, I at least know from New York, and now I'm not talking about fast casual or fast food restaurants, because those have better margins generally. But you know, I worked for a very large restaurant group called Be Our Guest, and 15% was their percentage to the bottom line, and that was with having their own linen company that they could basically run at a little bit of a loss or to break even, so they could sell linen to the 20 restaurants in their group at a lower price than any other restaurant could get from a linen group. That was having a centralized kind of commissary where they made all the bases for the desserts that got shipped out to all the restaurants. So mm-hmm. in order for them to, and then having a centralized, you know, events department, PR department, marketing, all those things being in-house. So it really took them having all those efficiencies across, you know, and this has included restaurants that did upwards of $18 to $20 million in revenue. So that's how they were able to support the idea of setting up this infrastructure to get the margins even better.
And you're doing some of this, as you said, Sean, at a loss, so you're getting the tax write-off or the loss, right?
Well, yeah, they were able to do that with the, at least that was my understanding, with the linens. But they were right, basically, okay. Or it's just, look, if you're selling events to, you're selling events to people and you have 17 venues and someone calls a central, you know, a central number and they say, oh, I'm looking for an event, 45 people, et cetera, this is my budget. And they can sell it across all those restaurants, and there's just an efficiency in putting one events person there. Whereas with smaller restaurants, realistically, you know, you're probably going to have someone wearing a bunch of hats and they have to deal with events plus something else. So I think there's, you know, there's efficiency with scale, and in so many businesses and restaurants are no different. But generally speaking, if, you know, to get back to where we started, yeah, it's just the margins are tight and there's a general expectation of what someone is willing to pay for a potato or a salad or a glass of wine, and you know,
and the experience that comes with it, right? I think that sometimes gets lost in the value equation, is that, you know, you're comparing grocery store prices or something to a cost of a potato, or I can go buy that bottle of Meiomi Pinot for $9.99 at Rouse's, and why is it $30 in a restaurant? Okay. I think people don't see the value proposition necessarily, that value added of going out in the environment.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, for sure. Look, I'll be the glass half full guy for a second. You can do well in restaurants. You just have to pay attention to the finances constantly. And you don't have to pay attention so much that it overlords everything else you do. I mean, the best thing about a restaurant being successful is have great people and take care of them, have great guests and take care of them. And if you do those two things, things kind of work. But you have to pay attention to the money, and it's not as important as the food, the cocktails, the hospitality, the team, the guest, but it's still really important. It's equivalent to free throws in basketball, or in another context, it's the least important part of a sum of really important parts. And I think that a lot of people are naive about that. I think there's a lot of old school attitude in the restaurant industry, in that if you're concerned with money or if you pay attention to money, that's not keeping it real, or that's not cool, or that means you're not doing it for the love, you're doing it for the money. And those are all fallacies that get people gashed upon rocks. And you have some great places that close because they don't pay attention to that stuff.
Now, Ro, do you think on that front, then, that maybe people think it's a trade-off where they in a misguided sense, think if I'm paying attention to the money, then what I'm actually shirking is hospitality?
Less that, and it's more of like a keep it real attitude that I say, okay, candidly. You know, it's not cool to make money. It's just that you're sort of a sellout a little bit in some respects. And so I think if you can get past that and you can let go of some of the way that it's always been done in restaurant approaches to things, you can make it a lucrative model. And look, you're never going to do as well in restaurants as you will with a tech startup. It's not a complete life of indentured servitude if you approach it the right way. The other thing that there's an opportunity to do in our business, particularly with younger guys like Sean and I, is you can take the model and you can sort of retool it and reinvent some things and turn some things on their head to make it more productive than it has been traditionally. And I don't think people are looking outside of the box to do that.
Ro, can I get you to hold that thought? Because I want to come back to that and get into that a little bit. We got to take a little bit of a break here, but let's come back with that, okay?
Absolutely.
Friends, coming back to the NOLA Drink Show, we're going to take a little bit of a break. We are chatting with Robert LeBlanc of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group and Sean Josephs of Kenton's. Come on back.
My book has got a hole in it. My book has got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand.
I'm Anthony Robinson, Metro Scan Traffic.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Fats Domino, walking to New Orleans. Friends chatting with Sean Joseph, proprietor of Kenton's Uptown, and Robert LeBlanc of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, four restaurants, Sylvain and Mobar in the French Quarter. As I mentioned, Cavan Uptown, just down the street there from Kenton's, and then also Barrel Proof in the lower Garden District. I'm going to coin that. I'm going to copyright that term, I think. Down in the LLG, I like to say. We're talking a little bit about the state of the restaurant industry here in New Orleans and elsewhere. And Ro, right before we went to the break, you're talking about some ways to maybe turn things on its head a little bit to change the playing field, I'm guessing, to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I think you just look at things and make things more efficient. So here's an example. If you marketing used to cost 5 or 6% of sales. Now with Facebook and social media and even paid advertising via Facebook and Google, you can spend maybe 1% of your sales on marketing, but you have to work really hard and you have to do things distinctive and you have to tell stories and you have to identify why you do what you do and you have to share the things that you believe in. You can't just market the features. So everybody's out there marketing features right now, so all the restaurants look exactly alike. If you market why your restaurant exists or what you believe about things, whether it's neighbors, food, team, experience, guest, design, people start to resonate with those things. But it takes a little bit of extra effort. But it saves you 4% of sales because you're not buying magazine advertisements and newspaper advertisements. You don't have to do that anymore to get an audience. And that's an example. So that takes your 5% margin to 9% right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking, Sean and I were talking about inventory management and...
Ro, before you go on from there, let me ask you a question. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, you know, we're sort of talking about these, and this is what I want to get into today a little bit, is the set expenditure categories. So with marketing, doing the social media stuff, like you talk about some of these things, maybe having, as you said, Sean, people wearing multiple hats, that can still be a challenge. So there's a fine line there, right, with who does what in-house on the team, how you go about that messaging and controlling it. Okay, yes, cost effective, but there still has to be messaging. And then when do you decide to step over the line and say hire a PR company, which I think that's an expense. And I think a lot of people don't know a lot of restaurants do use PR companies to help out with certain things.
Sean, you want to take it, or you want me to go?
Go ahead.
Okay. So I think it's about efficiency, right? So I think the time to hire a PR company is when managing media inquiries becomes so time consuming,
okay,
that it pulls you away from some of your core focuses. So that's usually a black and white decision for us when we engage a PR firm. It's when we're getting inquiries that we just can't physically handle efficiently. So we're missing leads and things like that because we can't get everything together. Whereas a PR firm is trained and they're designed to be able to handle those things instantaneously. That's when it's time for a PR firm. Something like social media, for me, I have a hard time. We did it for a little while with a great firm 7 years ago when we primarily had bars, but they're not on the ground. So they don't know how to convey the stories that are going on in real time. So social media to me is something that I think can be very difficult to ever outsource. But if you can use technology, you can get organized to make social media a little bit more efficient. So you're right. You're in the moment. You're setting up for a busy shift. You don't know what you're going to put on Instagram tonight. But you can use a social media content calendar on Google Sheets, which is free, and you can plan on Monday. You can spend 2 hours and plan what your social media is going to be like for the whole week. Now, it takes discipline to do that, and it takes organization, and you have to prioritize that to make sure you do that on Monday from 10 to 12 when nothing's going on, so that on Thursday at 5:30, the post is already lined up. It's already ready to go.
And it's done. And that's a really good point. You have to identify somebody to do it. But the one thing that I think is a couple things, really, Ro and Sean, feel free to jump in here as well. So what we're talking about, I think, with the PR company thing, and let me back up. One of the things I think is really important is, and having some experience with this in the wine industry, people would always say, what do I put on Twitter today? What do I put on Facebook today? What do I put on whatever platform today? My response then was always, what do I want to say today? And then you appropriately put that message out on the appropriate platform. I think that's a way to streamline this. Just a side note. But with the stuff with so the idea with the PR company then making that choice is to handle media inquiries, maybe potentially people want to do magazine pieces or come in and do a big gig Fandango thing. But you're still controlling the messaging and the storytelling then. You're not outsourcing that. I mean, I know you can, but in your case, you're not outsourcing the crafting of the story as much?
Correct. No. Okay. Yeah, your PR team's not necessarily, they're just helping you tell the story that you already crafted. And we do have back and forth with our PR team. There are some things that aren't the right fit for us and what we want to do, and so we won't do those things. I don't really believe that all press is good press. So that's one aspect of it. But the other thing about restaurants in terms of turning things on their head, today, in particular, restaurants are populated with really talented, really creative people. So you have fantastic photographers. You have people with fantastic taste in music. You have people who have amazing aesthetics and attention to detail. And so as opposed to one person controlling our social media, so I personally do all the physical posts, but the content is very open source. It comes from anybody. So anybody that's got an idea or anybody that gets a beautiful moment or a beautiful picture can just text it to me. And a lot of times you'll see on our posts, you'll see who took the photo. And that's basically how we source our social media. So I own the company and I'm responsible for a lot, and I'm disorganized, notoriously disorganized, and I could never manage that by myself if I spent my entire day and all my waking moments doing that. Because we have it outsourced, or we have open source, I'm sorry, and I'm getting stuff sent to me, it's very easy for me to manage and select the stories that we want to tell based on the themes that we're trying to push.
Cool. Awesome. Hold that thought. We're going to come back to that too and get into some other things related to specific cost categories of restaurants. Friends, come on back to the last half an hour of the Noel Drink Show. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, general manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucouleurs. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's grand dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon dining room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to over-oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po'boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market, Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickey Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's too lost soul. It takes all that long. Come on and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's too lost soul. It takes all that long.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, chatting with Sean Joseph of Kenton's and Robert LeBlanc of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. And we're talking a little bit during the break about wine programs and some of these things. We touched a little bit on PR guys and some of these sort of fixed category costs. And, Ro, you were talking about a way to save 4 or 5% was to in-house a lot of your marketing using social media, outsourcing it, which I really like that. You relying on your team, right, to tell the story. And anything you want to add there before we move on to kind of the next,
no, but
next
it's, topic? No, it's just an example that, you know, we have a lot of people in restaurants who care a lot about what we do, and they're all very talented. And if you just open it up to tap that resource, you'd be shocked at all the things that are available.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have, those are the boots on the ground, right, that can tell the story
absolutely.
For you.
And they are the story, right? And so they want to tell the story. So
right. Now, Sean, we were talking during the break here, really interesting. We're going to do a future show, near future show on this about wine and beverage programs, markup, smart choices, these things. But you said something very interesting. Traditionally, and probably a lot of listeners out there know that the standard model, just take wine as a good, easy example. You would take your wholesale price, you multiply that times three. That's what the bottle cost is on your wine list. And if you're selling wines by the glass, it was a 25% thing, meaning that you would sell four glasses out of a bottle. So if their wholesale price, pick an easy number, $15, it was $15 wholesale. Then I would basically recoup, if I charge $15 for the glass, recoup my bottle price on one glass. That sort of arbitrary, using your word that you just used during the break, thinking is not necessarily the way to go about this.
No, I think that there's a lot of opportunity, and you know, to find. I mean, we start by talking about ways to make profit, and you know, I think what Ro was saying, which does hold true, is you know, if you want to be successful, you obviously need to create a great environment. Great service, a great experience, and give people a great product. But you can't get locked into the idea that that means that you also can't find a way to make money. I mean, in order to be successful, you have to find a way to look at your model and find opportunities to be profitable wherever they exist. And, you know, as we were talking about with respect to wine by the glass, you know, in my mind, you know, as someone who enjoys wine, you can't say that all bottles of wine that cost $10 wholesale are created equal.
The dollar to performance ratio is the term I like to use.
Yeah. So dollar to performance ratio. Some $10 wholesale bottles of wine taste like $5 bottles of wine, and some of them taste like $15 bottles of wine. So I would argue that the ones that taste like $5 bottles of wine have no place on your list. And if you can find one that tastes like a $15 glass of wine and it costs you $10 a bottle, then you should use that to your advantage and make some margin there.
Yeah, that makes
and,
a lot
and
of
I
sense.
Think, you know, the word that will come up a lot in the restaurant business, which the negative side is someone would say that's gouging. You're like, oh, you're gouging me. And I would say, well, the role of a beverage professional is to actually understand quality relative to price and figure out what something is worth, not based on what they paid for it, but based on how it tastes. And if you're just going to wholesale, just say, I don't care how it tastes. No matter what bottle of wine you give me for my by the glass program, I'm just going to charge by the glass what I paid for the bottle. You know, you might as well just have a robot do it. Like, what's the point?
Right. It's just, that becomes a spreadsheet kind of decision, right? And this is when you get the sort of distributor coming in saying, I'll do your wine list for you.
Sure.
And then
you just mark them all up the same way.
And walk away.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, something interesting that you said too, Sean, was that, and we don't have to pick on any particular situation or varietal, but we do have a lot of people that will come into a restaurant and they will order the Pinot Grigio, or they will order the Chardonnay, or they will order, you know, lots of times it's vodka soda, or maybe they come in and they want Tito's. I hear that constantly right now for the vodka choice.
Right.
Now, how you price something there, and you're going to maybe move some of those and you're going to get something out of it, but then you want to put an interesting, like we're tasting a Chinon that you brought in, lovely Cab Franc from Loire. You want to introduce people to that. That's part of the, and we didn't talk about this during the break, but that's part of the experience, right? That's part of putting out a good presentation is teaching somebody something or exposing them to something new. And how do you leverage that, I guess is my question.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is, was it Rose? I don't know. Someone kept telling me recently vodka pays the bills.
Yeah, that's on, t-shirts and tails of the cocktail, man.
Maybe that's what it is. But I still think the idea is, you know, someone wants to drink their martini, you know, fantastic. That's great. There's never questioning someone's beverage choice. That kind of snobbery, I think, has zero place in a restaurant. But that said, I think, and Rose is getting to this with the staff, I think the best restaurants find a way to engage their staff to be excited about the food and excited about the beverage. And then that, in the end, just the sheer energy of getting people invested and curious about what's being served in the restaurant has a trickle-down effect to the guest, which in the end may just be delivered in the form of a smile. You know what I'm saying? It's just like if it becomes too redundant, then it's hard for them to go through service and find, you know, kind of the excitement and the energy that will bring out the best in hospitality. And so I think in that way, you do try to find a way to make the vodka pay for something else so that you can say, you know, have you ever had this cocktail called The Last Word? It's delicious and quite expensive to make. But if you're, you know, maybe you can afford to price The Last Word in a way where your margins aren't as good as they would be on your vodka in order to entice someone into trying this cocktail that does have expensive ingredients that they might never have had before. And I think that's how the two can kind of feed off of each other. And it's really, like I said, there's no criticism or judgment against the person that wants to drink the, you know, the glass of Pinot Grigio or just have their martini. But I think in a way you can use the money that comes from those sales and in a way have it kind of give the opportunity for people to try new things and maybe charge, you know, a lower margin on those items.
Yeah. And I think there's a value in that, guys. And maybe, Ro, if you agree with me on this, is that when you, I come into your restaurant and you turn me on to The Last Word cocktail, that's something that's actually going to stick with me. I'm going to remember your restaurant for the experience, the knowledge, the cool thing that I can go drop at the water cooler on my friends the next day. That there's a huge value in that, I think, right? And I think this is part of the presentation concept. It's on your cocktail list, maybe that gets you some press, people talk about it, but then you also have, I'm going to remember that. If I just come in and have a martini somewhere, I might remember it if it's solid, but I'm not coming away with new knowledge. And I think there's a huge value in that.
Yeah, we talk about this all the time at LeBlanc Smith. It, you know, dining out is the last form of live entertainment to evolve. So people used to go to restaurants before or after going to a concert or a play in a theater. And now I find they go to restaurants instead. And we talk all the time about that. you're creating this experience that you want people to, it's got to be warm and engaging is the most important two things, but it's also got to be memorable. And if you present something to someone they've never had, or you present something slightly differently, that's the greatest way to create a memory for them. And we should think about ourselves more like theater than we do, I think. I think right now we are still, as an industry, restaurants are still a little too mired in the science of it. The science of the preparation of this food item, or the science of the preparation of this cocktail. And we are not at all giving enough credence or attention to the theater of it. And theater is very important.
Now, how on that front, then, how people you hire, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Environment, I mean, what are some of the considerations? What would be to create the theater? What is it that you're looking for getting away from ingredient list and markup?
So this is a great example. I'm not trying to flatter them, but I did a pinhook presentation at Barrel Proof last week, and they asked me to do the same at Cavern today. So we do tastings every 2 weeks, and the tastings aren't just about the notes and the toasted almonds that you're supposed to pick up and the caramel tones, and this is the name of the stables that name the whiskey. It's about the story behind how the whiskey was created, the company was started, and it's all these cultural touch points. And so what we start with is give them a deeper, more well-rounded knowledge of the products, not just the scientific aspects of the product that you could find on a website, but with the human interest piece of the product. And that's where it starts for us, and we try to attract people who are interested in those aspects of it, and that's what we share. So Pinhook's a great whiskey. You can go to any restaurant that carries Pinhook, and they can talk to you about the tasting notes. You can go to Cavern, and they can probably talk, and I know they do it at Kenton's as well because of the owners involved in both, but you can go to Cavern, and they're going to tell you sort of that it was started by three guys in New York who had this idea, and they can tell you that it's 2,800 bottles total, and they can tell you why that is, and they can tell you about the Castle and Key Association and all these things you can't really pick up, and that's theater. That's how you move people. You don't move people with science.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sean, same question to you. Anything to add to that?
I think what it made me think of, even though I think it's on the same topic, but maybe a non sequitur, is I was thinking about, Ro was talking about theater. I feel like restaurants, with the amount of technology that exists, one of the things that I really love about restaurants is I think they're as close to the way they were 100 years ago. And I think that will continue. And I think the more other things become digital and the more that all of these experiences get taken online, I just, can you imagine if you were in the CD business and then one day someone was like, sorry, dude, the MP3 is here. You're done. Yep. I don't think that's ever going to happen with restaurants, right? I don't think, what would that be? People want to be in a public environment to enjoy food and beverage with loved ones and family, colleagues, etc. And I think that experience is going to become one of the few things that kind of roots us to this more elemental thing. What do you need in a restaurant? You need fire to cook the food. You need some refrigeration. You need alcohol. You need tables and chairs, and you need people to take care of you. And I think that
rock and roll
and rock and roll. But I think that's I think there are going to be fewer and fewer experiences like that left, and that's one thing I really love about restaurants is maybe it sounds like almost old. I'm not the old fashioned person. I like the direction everything's going in, but I think it's nice to be rooted in some of those simple things. I think if you go into a restaurant, even still, and Ro was talking about the technology behind food, but in the end of the day, is there still anything better than a steak cooked over a wood fire?
Yeah, there you go.
What will ever, people have tried to put food in a cryovac bag and drop it into a water bath. But I think in the end, there's certain things that just can't be beat, like meat and fire. And
somebody bringing it to you with a smile.
Someone bringing it to you with a smile while you have a really cold martini or a really nice bottle of red wine. I think that's one of the great things that will always be there, and it's one of the things I love about restaurants.
It's funny, Sean, and we're going to take a break here in a second. It seems what happens too when somebody tries to imbue a bunch of technology into the situation. So we've seen some of these things pop up where you can order on an app, right? Or you have the machine sitting on the table where you don't interact with a server, and you put your order in on the little kiosk thing sitting on your table. And that seems to what happens to me is it doesn't make a particular, like what we're talking about, independent sit-down restaurants, that genre disappear. It actually just either alters a different track of restaurant or creates a different entirely indifferent environment. It doesn't, if that makes sense, it doesn't cause something to go extinct. It's actually just something else. And I mean, there are people that seemingly do want to order on an app and go get their Big Mac or whatever it is, and then they don't have to actually talk to somebody. But that's never going to replace or alter what you're talking about.
I do appreciate it at the airport, though. Just when I want that beer,
yeah,
layover.
Right. There you go. There is an application. You guys are going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, chatting with Robert LeBlanc and Sean Josephs, and we're going to talk. Oh, we got one more segment to talk about the restaurant business. Friends, come on back.
Ain't got nothing in my pocket, but if I did, I'd give half to you.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's Southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show here on WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. If you're listening to the podcast, I appreciate that too. As always, chatting with my good friends Robert LeBlanc and Sean Josephs. We're talking a little bit about the restaurant industry. And it's always an interesting conversation, friends, because we never know which way it's going to go. So, guys, I got to get you to agree to this if it's okay, because one of the things I really wanted to talk about, which we don't really have a ton of time for, is some more of these sort of fixed cost categories. And I think labor is a really interesting one, but there's, you know, more to get into than that. You know, shortage of labor, cost of labor, these things. But one thing that one of y'all said a while back that we touched on, this the no tip model that has popped up, and I don't think we've really seen it here. I'm not aware of it here anywhere in particular. Maybe there is. What do you all think about that?
I mean, I would say, from what, you know, New York is, you know, an environment that is at least set up to go in that direction, because sorry, I don't know how much time. I'll try to keep it short. But anyway, the bottom line is, like, so the federal tipped wage is $2.13, right? So that's what a restaurant needs to pay any employee who's in the tip pool. New York, as of 2016, was, I'm sorry, as of 2015, was $5 an hour. As of 2016, was $7.50. Over the next couple few years, we'll go up to, I think, $10.10. The minimum wage in Manhattan is going up to $15 by the end of 2018.
And that includes anybody in the tip pool as well? That's straight across the board minimum wage?
No, so that would be... So the idea of the tipped wage is that it's the restaurant's way of helping an employee get to minimum wage. At least that was the initial kind of idea of it.
Okay.
And I think that the challenge that has arisen is there are certain restaurants where the servers and bartenders, food runners, don't really need the help from the restaurant because they're already making $25 or $30 an hour. But the law has been put in place because there are restaurants that are basically trying to take advantage, not pay people a living wage, essentially, by just, it would basically be a restaurant where people don't make that much in tips. Mm-hmm. So then their tipped wage plus their minimum wage, or their tipped wage, I'm sorry, plus their tips basically just gets them to minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
But as you can imagine, I'm sure Roe would be, if Roe had to consider this in his head, it would be painful. Imagine every employee that he has that he pays $2.13 if he had to pay them $10 an hour.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
it would be brutal.
We talked about it with our team, just to, you know, everything in our company kind of, for the most part, the team decides, right? And so when the idea first came up and Danny Meyer made that choice, I presented it to our front of house team at Sylvain, and they all revolted. I mean, they threw tomatoes at me. So the reality of it is, I think in our types of restaurants, people don't necessarily want it. Now, I understand the fact that they're trying to raise it to protect the back of house hourly labor, which has historically been taken advantage of. But in our restaurant group, for the most part, back of the house is almost already there. So, you know, I think it's just kind of that you have to make sure you take care of both front of house team and back of house team. And if you do that, you just let them decide. But I'll tell you, the problem is that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. So to go to that model, you have to increase your prices, and then you have to assume that guests are going to be willing to pay prices that are 20% higher. And if that doesn't work, the whole thing crumbles. Mm-hmm. And so it's impossible to kind of make that choice. You're talking about something that's been institutionalized for better or worse over a long period of time, and you're not going to change it by passing up one law, because you're not going to be able to move the guest expectation to paying 20 or 25% higher prices so the restaurant can just be profitable and stay open as quickly as you're going to change the wage. And so you're going to have a lot of people that are going out of business, and you have a lot of people that were otherwise earning healthy incomes, both front of house and back of house teams, who are out of jobs just because the market didn't catch up as quickly as the law was expecting it to.
Just to be clear, that what's led New York, at least the idea of starting with Danny Meyer and other people, to look at no tipping, is that once you have to pay a dishwasher $15 an hour, and once you have to pay a server $10 an hour instead of $2.13 an hour, on top of the tips that they're already getting, the restaurant is no longer viable.
Right.
At least at its current menu pricing structure. When you go to no tipping, and it's not a service charge, it's literally just you have included everything in the price of a beer, wine by the glass, etc., then you can distribute the money that comes in however you like across your entire staff. So let's say, for argument's sake, a $5 million restaurant, everyone tips 20%. That's an additional $1 million in revenue that come in tips. Mm-hmm. Now you build it into your pricing. Now instead of a $5 million restaurant, you're a $6 million restaurant, and you get to distribute the money amongst your staff however you see fit. The problem, which I think Robert was getting at a little bit, that people have seen when they try it in New York, is people are very specific in how they buy things in a restaurant. So if you're most people always buy the same price bottle of wine, generally speaking. Maybe it's an anniversary, they'll spend more. But the $50 bottle now costs $60 because the service is included. Instead, they buy the $50 bottle, which is actually a $40 bottle. Mm-hmm. So the restaurants are going revenue negative.
Right.
That's basically what's happening.
Thank you, Sean, for saying that. You guys, sorry, you guys will come back because I want to continue this conversation. We'll do this again in 2-3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Yeah, man.
Excellent. Thank you. Sean Joseph from Kenton's. Check them out. Robert LeBlanc, LeBlanc Smith. That's Sylvain Cavan Mobar. Barrel Proof. Check that out. Friends, come on back to the show next week. We're going to record at Bakery Bar as we do once a month. And hey, until then, cheers, y'all.